Alzis foresti, teodas mi, yet what is hell who tends a thee?
Gifts can take on many shapes and sounds. This gift of music is in Daketh, the language of the Klaitli Tene people in northern British Columbia. Language teacher Sherry Chai reimagined three classic Christmas songs and wrote Daketh versions with the help of late Klaitli elder Edie Frederick and linguist Bill Poser. Jennifer Piggin, the district principal of Indigenous education in Prince George, performed the song.
A spark on line nil en yakas il tsa.
Very few people speak Daketh, making recordings like this a precious gift to future generations. It's just one of the gifts we're opening for you today, because whether it's Merry Christmas, Blessed Solstice, or a Happy New Year, this season is full of reasons to give. Tante, Anin, Buju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Author Monique Gray Smith remembers the gifts sent from her ancestors. They're like a lit candle during her darkest days.
Our ancestors take care of us. And my experience is they show up in all kinds of ways that we are so taken care of.
And whether it's a simple mug or a priceless piece of art, every gift given in a potlatch carries a story. Amelia Ray is sharing those stories in an exhibit that spotlights the hideaway of giving.
I wanted to put a focus on the gifts as kind of a way to show and to say, you know, this is actually how we give, this is how we care for our people.
Plus, you think holiday cooking is stressful? Imagine cooking a full Christmas dinner every single week. That's the kind of love and care Kat Monroe and Saskatoon's Seventh Generation Rising put into every meal they cook for community members in need.
And so we really are feeding the elderly, the children, lots of single moms, and just trying to take care of each other as best we can.
Today, Indigenous people who fill bellies, hearts, and souls with the gift of food, love, and light. This time of year can be stressful. Days are colder and nights are longer. Sometimes it can be hard to find the joy. And for some, there is more darkness than light. Writer Monique Gray Smith faces those dark times with the light shared with her by her mother. The ability to find light in dark times is something that she learned from her. Through childhood experiences of homelessness, long work days, and deep uncertainty, Monique's mom still managed to create small moments of joy. Her mother's teachings, ceremonies, and unwavering resilience continue to shape Monique's life today. And they are the heart of her new book, Sharing the Light, Stories and Reflections. Monique, welcome to Unreserved.
Always a privilege to sit with you, Rosanna.
Always a privilege to sit with you as well. You're such a lovely light, and now I know why. Your mother, Shirley, is such a central presence in this book. How would you describe her?
Oh, as joy and as laughter and as happiness. And also, you didn't mess with her. Right? So she had this fire in her that if you crossed the line, it was not okay. And she was never disrespectful, but she had a way of also, you know, as she would say, she would tune me in.
Absolutely. Sounds like a lot of mothers I know, mine included.
Right. And many of our aunties.
Right, exactly. What did you, you know, grow up watching her do?
Oh, one, for sure, work hard. Two, but also in that, enjoy life. You know, she curled, she had friends, she was part of community. She was vibrant. Everybody who met her loved her, and she let us know that people loved her. She wasn't shy about, you know, people also sharing that she was enamored by people.
What are some of the hardships that your mom navigated?
Being removed at birth in 1940, you know, and living for the first 4 years in an orphanage. So we talk about the 60s scoop, but that was happening long before 1960. And as a result of that, many of those documents that are somewhat available to 60 Scoop survivors and later are even less available to those who were before that 1960s kind of term that we have now come associated with. And so she lived for the first 4 years in an orphanage and then moved to a family just outside of Regina, and she was later adopted there. But she was the only child of any color in that community and often talked about the racism that she experienced and how that made her feel. And I, as you know, I can be easily white passing, and I also saw many times with her the racism, the following in stores, all the innuendos, all those pieces, and what I would see her shrink a little bit each and every time.
Yeah, that's a lot to have to deal with. And you know, when you were a child, how did those hardships impact you?
I think for me, in ways, I hid because it was one too hard to see, and I couldn't see the difference between her and I. I didn't see color in that way as a child. So all I saw was her shrink, and then what I learned from that was that I had to hide. And I think that was part of why I turned to alcohol at a very young age, was because it allowed me to kind of show up a little bit, to be a little more perhaps courageous at times. But what I learned as I got older was watching how remarks would have her shrink, but then within an hour or two, she was back to herself. And what I learned in that is that people can use their tongues to cause harm, but it's my choice to let that harm land or not.
Do you have a story that you could share that really, you know, stands out in your mind of how she did that or what happened?
And this is in Tilly, my first novel. There's a scene where we're in Kelowna in Rutland, and I'm hanging onto her hand and I'm bouncing along. I must have been 4 or 5. I was bouncing along. And then all of a sudden, I hit something and I flew back. And this man said, I hit his tummy. We were walking, I wasn't paying attention. I hit his stomach and I bounced back. And he made a very racial, harsh remark to my mom. And she just grabbed my hand, and her hand was ice cold and wet. I remember that. And I was like, what just happened, right? And she just really shrunk almost to the size of me. And then as we walked farther, she started to kind of bounce back. And when we got home, she went to the garden and she worked in her garden. And when she came in from her garden, she was back. Yeah, that's one story that I think about.
Really finding a grounding literally in the ground, working with the, you know, the earth. That's a wonderful lesson to watch, you know, as a child, and that being impactful. How did your mom provide other, you know, ways of lightness, or, you know, provide light to you in heavy times?
She was one of the key reasons why I stopped drinking, in April, it'll be 36 years. But I know that had I not made that decision by her encouragement, I would not be alive today. I have no question about that, Rosanna. But her encouragement, and also, she called me to task a number of times when my drinking really impacted her and her life's experiences. And she was always like, there's more for you than this. Like, she had a vision for both my sister and I that was, I think, even beyond what she could in her imagination see. But she knew that she was raising girls who would not live what she had lived. And she did all she could to make sure that our paths got back on track.
Was there some, what was the moment for you when you decided that that was going to be something that you did, you know, put down the addiction and to lead a, you know, a better life? Was it because of your mom and what she said, or what was the moment for you?
Oh, I was working in Vancouver and she came to visit. Both of my parents were huge sports fans, hockey, curling, baseball especially. And Wayne Gretzky was playing for the Los Angeles Kings and they were visiting Vancouver. And so I got us tickets. And we'd gone for dinner. I'd had a couple drinks. At the game, I had a couple drinks. And between the second and third period, I passed out of my seat. That's how many drinks I'd had. And she gave me a very harsh elbow. She's like, come on, we're leaving. And we left and went back to the hotel. The next morning, I went downstairs to get coffee. And right there on the front of the Province magazine, Gretzky scores natural hat trick in the third period. So my drinking caused my mom's face, her missing her favorite player's natural hat trick. And she never said anything to me, but I could see in her eye how disappointed she was. And that was one of the key turning points for me.
That is a beautiful and sad example of that strength that your mom, you know, showed to you as a child and as an adult. What did you learn for her, take from her, carry on from her as an adult into your own adult life to practice joy and light?
Yeah, first thing in the morning to start with gratitude, right? She always did that. That was one of her ways. And she would often say it out loud to us. The other is whenever you left her presence, she would stand and she would wave kind of up and down like this. And she would say, have fun. That was always her last words, have fun. And I think that, you know, when we think about light, those words like have fun, they're like, they are like sharing light as people leave, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have a different energy than be careful or, you know, all those other things. It was always like she had faith that everything would be okay. And what she wanted for us was to have fun in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the other side of that is the hardship part, right? How did your memories of the hard times with your mom guide you as an adult?
Well, there's a story in Sharing Our Light about when we're living in Nelson and we don't have a house to live in, and her decisions about, you know, hauling the laundry across the bridge, doing laundry, and always finding change in the bottom of the washers at the laundromat. And we would go next door to Dairy Queen and we'd have an ice cream. So she made this, you know, this experience of not having a home, of, you know, hauling these black bags across the bridge to do our laundry. At the end, there was joy. And, you know, if there was a little extra money, there was French fries and an ice cream, you know. And to this day, I have so many memories of her loving going for a soft ice cream cone.
That's beautiful. One of the other stories that you share in your book is about a lava rock. Can you share that with us, the story about the lava rocks?
We were having, when my mom died, my sister and I inherited her house, and we were having major renovations done by a family friend named Lois. And when she was doing the bathroom, she was putting up the tiling on the bathtub, and it was a new tub, so she'd put cardboard on the bottom. And my daughter went to visit the next day, and we were on FaceTime, and Lois is like, the strangest thing happened today. And I was like, my mom had been showing up to Lois a few times, moving things. And I was like, oh yeah, what's that? And she said, today when I came in, and Lois was the only person who had a key to the house. Today when I came in, there was a big lava rock in the bottom of the tub. She's like, I have no idea how that got there. So my daughter's, you know, raising her eyebrow on the FaceTime, like, what? And I was like, I know how that got there. Because when I was still living in Kamloops, every Sunday we'd go and sweat with my Uncle David Antoine and Rod Jeffries and other folks. And when my mom shifted, the hospital changed, she couldn't come on Sundays anymore. And my Uncle David came and he brought her four big grandfathers. And he said to her, the big lava rocks, and he said to her, you can have your own sweat. He said, put these in the oven at 500 degrees on a cookie sheet and then take them into the bathroom, put them in the tub and splash some water and some tobacco and some cedar on them and have your own sweat. He said, you know, our ceremonies aren't bound to one place. They can come with us wherever we go. He said, so when you can't come to the lodge, you can have your own ceremony. And I was like, that's where that lava rock came from. Mom brought a rock. I took it as a reminder to myself to be nourishing my spirit. Mm. You know, it was still a rough time in our house. It wasn't long since my mom had died. My wife was battling cancer and there was definitely darkness. So it was this reminder to come back to ceremony and to nourish my spirit.
Still taking care of you.
Right?
That's wonderful. Why did you want to share that particular story with readers?
Well, I think that one might, for some people, be like, I don't know how that happened, right? But mm-hmm. It's a reminder that our ancestors take care of us. And that was a visible, physical reminder. But I think, in my experiences, they show up in all kinds of ways that we are so taken care of. And we forget to ask sometimes, or we forget to offer thanksgiving for them and their care for us. And so I just thought, when we talk about light, that's part of the light. Like in my, I don't know about you, Rosanna, but in my darkest times, having faith that the ancestors are taking care of me is like a candle lit, right? It's like, okay, I will get through. They got through, so how the heck am I now going to get through?
You know, you are a remarkable writer in that you are so open and you are so trusting, I suppose, with your readers that they're going to accept that vulnerability as an offering. You share some very personal stories about your life in the book. What gives you or gave you the courage to be so open?
I think it's the only way to have change in the world and to bring light is to share our own vulnerabilities. And not every single thing, Rosanna, right? But things that are safe enough to share. That can be, it's light for me and myself when I share it, but then it can shed light for others. Like, okay, I'm facing this, but this person faced this and they were okay. So I will be okay. Or maybe I'll even be better than okay. Right. And I think it's in our vulnerability that we actually expand our courage. I don't know. I just saw my mom. I saw my dad. I see my sister. I see my wife in her battle right now. Yeah, that chokes me up because courage it's a form of medicine. And it's not one that we often talk about.
Hmm.
Yeah, but these times that we're in, I think, are requiring us to be courageous.
Yes. You write about cookie people. What are cookie people?
These people who come into our lives, sometimes just for a moment, or sometimes they walk with us through our whole life. And there are people who see us, they see the gifts in us, they sometimes speak our future. But when we're in their presence, we feel bigger and better about ourselves. And I don't mean by ego, but because of their love, because of their care, it's like, okay, I can take another step, or I can take a massive step, or I can be vulnerable and write stories that who knows what will happen when they're out in the world, right? And I think about them, like my daughter, Sadie, makes the most amazing chocolate chip cookies. And we had a neighbor when I was in kindergarten, 5 years old. Her name was Mrs. Gladys, and she used to bring cookies home over to our house. It's like she knew when there was turmoil or even trauma happening in our house. She'd come through the back gate and knock on the back door, and she'd have a plate of cookies, sometimes banana bread, but mostly cookies. And after that whole plate was empty, because everybody would come to the table, she would leave and everyone would feel better. For sure, the cookies, right? But her presence is really what made the difference. So that's why I call them cookie people, is because when we're in their presence, we feel bigger and better about ourselves. And I feel like we need a lot of cookie people throughout our life. Sometimes they come in for a moment and they change our whole trajectory.
Yes, absolutely. How do these cookie people like Miss Gladish help you heal?
Oh, I think her love was medicine for me. Mm. I think about, you know, this woman at UVic years ago, who, when I was applying to the School of Social Work, said to me, "I look forward to reading your book one day." That was the first seed. I didn't even write for another 20 years, Rosanna. But when she said that, like, my heart pounded. I got covered with goosebumps because she spoke my future, right? She saw a gift in me. And she spoke that future. She changed my trajectory. I was in that meeting interview for maybe like 40 minutes. And then I never did go to social work school. I went traveling instead. But that moment changed my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody has a story, and yours is, you know, very remarkable. And you've continuously been brave. You've been courageous. You've been loving. And as we move into the holiday season, you know, it's a time that can feel heavy for many people, and it's hard to stay in that light. What kinds of, you know, gentle first steps would you suggest for someone trying to find even a little bit of light in their life?
Yeah, I come back to my mom and starting with gratitude, you know, before feet even hit the floor in the morning or before we crawl out of bed, just offering some gratitude for the safe passage through the night. For a warm blanket, If we're blessed to have a roof over our head, for the roof over our head, the safe passage of our loved ones, starting with those what may seem like simple but sometimes aren't simple pieces of gratitude, offering thanks for the giving that is coming. I love that when we think about that Haudenosaunee Thanksgiving address, right? Like offering that thanks for all the beauty and bounty is coming to us. And having faith that it will come, all good things in their rightful time, and if they're in our highest good, they will come.
Well, thank you for sharing some of of your joy and your light today with me.
I'm mirroring back your light also, Rosanna. Yeah.
Thank you.
Monique Gray Smith is Cree, Lakota, and Scottish. Her new book, Sharing the Light, Stories and Reflections, will be available on January 27th, 2026. Still ahead.
Holding one in my hand, I was looking at it and just really feeling the weight, and really just had a moment with a mug. And I was feeling the weight of a potlatch and how many there were, how many she attended, and how many that she accepted and affirmed agreement with.
A simple treasure in her auntie's cupboard led Amelia Ray to celebrate the sacred practice of potlatching. In her exhibit, Indian Giver, she's busting myths about how Indigenous people give. That's coming up in just a few minutes. The Dunkath language is spoken by very few people today. Just a little over 1,000 speakers remain. Sherry Chai is a language teacher in Prince George. Originally from Singapore, Ms. Chai now works alongside elders, knowledge keepers, and linguists to pass the Dunkath language on to students. She recorded songs like this one to be a resource for other teachers and a gift to language learners on the traditional territory of the Kletlitene people. The songs are not direct translations, but instead simple winter stories told in Dunkath, the tune of popular holiday classics. That is Golden Bells in the tune of Jingle Bells. It was written by Sherry Chai and vetted by linguist Bill Poser. Drumming and singing is by Jennifer Piggott and Sherry Chai. The rattle was played by Tache elder Charlie Joseph. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, lessons in giving. For Indigenous nations on the West Coast, the potlatch serves many purposes. The ceremonial feast can mark births, weddings, and funerals. It brings communities together and cements relationships. Gift giving is a big part of this practice. But Amelia Ray will tell you, potlatch gifts aren't really gifts. There's something much more. Amelia is Haida from the community of Olmasset in Haida Gwaii. When Amelia noticed some familiar potlatch gifts in her auntie's cupboard, she had the idea to put the potlatches past and present on display. Her exhibit, Indian Giver, is now at the Bill Reid Gallery in Vancouver. Amelia, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, it's really nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. So take me to your auntie's house. What did you discover in her cupboards?
Sure. So where I'm situated, I'm about 2-minute walk from her house. So I'm very familiar to just going over there, sometimes inviting myself over for dinner or for lunch. And so I was at her house one day a couple of years ago and opened up her kitchen cupboard, which I had done many times before. I was going in for a cup, for a glass of water or a cup of tea or whatever it was. And I kind of took a moment and paused and was looking at this super tall cupboard and realized all of those mugs were from potlatches. And there had to have been at least 50 to 100 mugs in this cupboard.
Wow.
It's a very big kitchen cupboard. And holding one in my hand, I was looking at it and just really feeling the weight, and really just had a moment with a mug. And I was feeling the weight of a potlatch and how many there were, how many she attended, and how many that she accepted and affirmed agreement with. you know, just thinking about the potlatch as a whole and how it's changed, how what we give as payment during potlatches has changed through time.
Mm.
And somehow it turned into an exhibition.
Well, it always just starts with a little idea or a mug.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a thirst.
Exactly.
How is a potlatch gift different from other kinds of gifts?
Well, I think a potlatch gift, you know, it's not really a gift in itself. It's actually a payment. It's a payment to the witness from the host of the potlatch. And when you are giving something, you're paying them for witnessing anything that happened. Names that were given, marriages, alliances formed, memorializing a person who has passed away, poll raisings, a chieftainship, whatever it might have been, you're paying the witness for witnessing. And it can be really anything. They can be incredibly grand, or something that can be used in your kitchen every day, like a mug or a pack of Tupperware, or you know, whatever it might be. You're paying them for being there.
Mm. And so, why did you want to share these potlatch gifts with the world?
I wanted to look at the potlatch through another lens. I think the potlatch is a topic that has been exhibited a number of times through multiple lenses, and I wanted to put a focus on the gifts as kind of a way to show and to say, you know, this is actually how we give, this is how we care for our people, this is how, I wanted to bring it to the present and to show it as a living piece of our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's this idea that the potlatch was a way for chiefs to boast, you know, about their wealth and to show off that they could have these extravagant potlatches. So what you're saying is that's not exactly what's going on there.
Yeah, I think, you know, the word potlatch in itself, actually, it means to give. And the way that we see wealth is so different than a Western world. You're wealthier for giving away everything you have, right down to the clothes on your back. You know, you're wealthier for giving to your people, for giving to your neighbors, for giving to invited guests, when you take care of your business, whatever that might be, whatever you need to do within a potlatch. You're wealthier for giving of yourself.
Yeah. What role has the potlatch played in your life?
In my life? I have been potlatching my entire life. I think I'm one of the first generations, not the first, but one of the first generations on Haida Gwaii who will never know a life without potlatching since the potlatch ban, which is really beautiful. And it makes me really excited. I have a little niece and she gets so excited to be in the feast hall, to be watching the masks, to just be in that environment. It reminds me of when I was little and being so excited to go to the hall and to potlatch and to witness. And so my experience with the potlatch is really personal. It's something that carries a lot of responsibility. You know, I'm touching my chest right now, because I that's where I feel responsibility is. It's a weight on your chest. And as this generation that I'm in now, we have a responsibility to carry that forward and to revitalize and bring as much of this back for these little ones in our lives who are so excited just to be Haida.
Yeah.
And just to be witnessing.
The potlatch ban enacted by the federal government here in Canada was lifted in 1951. Do you have a favorite, you know, potlatch that you have experienced?
Oh, I think my actual favorite potlatch that I've been a part of and I've been witness to was the first potlatch on Haida Gwaii after the pandemic, which was hosted by my uncle Christian White, where he raised a totem pole in front of his longhouse here in Old Masset. And you could just feel the excitement in the room and how proud everyone was to be back in our feast hall, back to witnessing, back to raising poles after such a period of time. It was really beautiful and really exciting. And I think I'll remember that for the rest of my life.
That sounds beautiful. For your exhibit, where did you look for potlatch items to display?
Oh, good question. I felt a lot of anxiety leading up to my exhibit because the potlatch is so sacred to us. I just really didn't want to misstep. I really didn't want to upset my community in any way. I didn't want to show anything that I shouldn't. So I went to my aunties, I went to my mom, I went to my community, and I kind of talked to them about what I was planning on showing and asked them what they might have in their own collections. And then I was opened up to this beautiful archive of potlatches, not just on Haida Gwaii, but in other communities along the coast. And they were all just so receptive of course you can borrow this. Of course you can put this up. Of course you can talk about how this is significant to our people. And so a lot of it is actually, if it's not the collection of my aunties or my family, it's the collection of myself and my mom. And the first time I walked my mom through the exhibit, she was like, well, this is kind of weird, just looking at all my stuff. I was like, well, you got to show the people.
Yeah, that would be a very strange experience walking through a high-end museum and seeing your mug collection in there.
Yeah, totally. Or, you know, necklaces that we wear often and prints that are usually on our walls. You know, these they're all things that are used and were given through potlatch.
Tell me about the piece of a wool blanket that's part of your exhibit and what the story behind that little piece of wool is.
Yeah, so in the exhibition, I decided to stack up a number of wool blankets. And on top of it, there's one that's just a rag, basically. That comes from a story that comes out of the village of Yon, which was a shared village between my family's clan and a Raven clan. This story was documented by Murdoch, who was an anthropologist at Yale. And he, compared to other anthropologists and explorers that were coming into our territories at that time, did a really good job of showing that Haida people are matrilineal and everything we inherit comes from our matrilineal line, comes from our mothers and our grandmothers. And so the story, it's about a woman named Stathkoas, who comes from my clan, and she was hosting a potlatch for the building of her house and for the raising of a pole in front of her house. And at this potlatch, she paid her midwives, her children were adults at that time. She paid the builders and the carvers and anybody who helped her come to that point. And at the very end of the potlatch, she had nearly 1,000 wool blankets stacked up in her house. And she was handing them out to people who had, if she thought they spoke well, if she thought they danced really well, or if they had done something for her to help her, she paid them for it until she got down to the very last blanket, which was no more than a rag. And she held it up and she said, I'm going to give this to my husband for all the work that he did, in a very cheeky way. It was my mom sent me that story, that article, and we've loved it. It's been this beautiful treasure of potlatch history for our family. And when I read that, I also read it in my mom's voice because I could 100% picture my mom doing something like that in her own cheeky way. And I loved that the cheekiness and the humor really shine through in the story. And that's something I wanted to highlight, is that our potlatches are very serious events, but there's also a lot of joy and a lot of humor. And just as there is in our lives, that is also in our potlatch systems.
Thank you for sharing that story. The exhibition is called Indian Giver, NDN Giver. Why did you choose that name?
Yeah, I wasn't too sure what I was going to call it for a long time. And then one day I was kind of just scrolling on whatever, and Indian Giver just popped up, and maybe it was an article talking about the history of that term. It kind of just clicked in me that, you know, that's a term that's rooted in misunderstanding and racism. It's something that I heard even as a kid, being used in a derogatory way by other kids who, of course, just didn't know better. And I wanted to kind of reclaim it and say, hey, you know, this is actually how we give. And this is actually how we take care of our people. This is how we build relationships with one another and how we uphold those relationships. And so I wanted to, yeah, just flip it and turn it around. And I think I did that, which is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. I love how you turned that phrase around and said, actually, we're not the ones that are giving bad deals up in this place. just to clarify. It is cheeky. You mentioned cheeky earlier. What does it mean for, you know, to give in an Indigenous way? What does it mean for you?
To give everything you have. It's to take care of your people. It's to take care of your loved ones, take care of your neighbor. It's to show respect. You know, it doesn't have to be so super grand. I think that's what the mug tells us. It doesn't need to be a huge grand gesture to show you care about someone and to show them, you know, that I will look out for you. I will have your back. It can be something very simple. And I think that's something I'm really thinking about this year as we come up onto the holiday season. I've been spending a lot of time hand-making gifts and just really putting time into the care that I'm making, whatever I'm making for the people that I love. I think that's what giving means to me.
Yeah. What kind of world do you think we would have if everyone potlatched?
In my mind, it would be much simpler. I think, you know, this Western way of wealth and greed, needing the top gadgets or, you know, the top of the line every year, I think it's exhausting. Yeah, I'm tired. And I think if we all sat together, if we all ate a meal together, if we all listened to what was happening in people's families, witnessed how they were taking care of their people, I think that would make things a lot simpler.
Yeah.
And they're fun.
Yes, of course. They're super fun. And as, you know, part of the generation who was able to pick it up in your lifetime from it being banned, what do you hope that, you know, you mentioned you're an auntie. What do you hope your niece and future generations, how will they carry it forward?
Mm-hmm. That makes me really excited. You know, my mom, I remember her telling me stories about her grandmother using an ice cream bucket as a drum and putting paper bags over the heads of my mom and her cousins to teach them to mass dance. And by the time that I came around, there were masks carved for me to learn with, which, you know, in my mom's generation, there wasn't much left in our community for them to hold in their hands and to actually use. And that switched by the time I came around. And now to look at my niece, who's 4, and she has many artists in her family who she's not shy to go and ask them, I want this mask. Can I have this mask? I want this button blanket, and I want it to look like this. She's, you know, she's not shy to tell us what kind of regalia she wants, what kind of songs she wants to listen to, what dances she wants to dance. And it's really nice to see her and really beautiful to watch her grow into this little being who just loves being Haida and isn't shy about it. She'll scream it from the top of her lungs, and I take a lot of pride in it, and I'm very excited to be a big person in her life that can teach her and to show her and guide her the same way that my mom and my aunties guided me.
Well, thank you so much for that and for sharing some of your time with me today, Amelia.
Thank you for having me.
Amelia Ray is Haida from the community of Olmasset in Haida Gwaii. She's the curator behind the exhibit Indian Giver. It's on at the Bill Reid Gallery in Vancouver until February 22nd. Good Snowman, written by Sherry Chai and vetted by linguist Bill Poser. Drumming and singing by Jennifer Piggin and Sherry Chai. The Rattle was played by Tache Elder Charlie Joseph. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, cooking up plates of love and hope for the new year. In a full kitchen in Saskatoon, Kat Monroe and her volunteers are cooking up some festive spirit. Every Sunday at the Central Urban Métis Federation, members of the group Seventh Generation Rising cook hearty meals for community members in need. They've been making these dinners every week since March. But in December, dinner has a Christmas twist. Turkey, mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, gravy, and more. For Kat, cooking for her community is all part of being a good relative. Kat, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you for inviting me.
So take me into your kitchen on a December Sunday. What are we seeing and hearing and, more importantly, smelling?
Well, I think it's really important that everyone has that really amazing family meal and everyone gets to be a part of that. And that includes waking up at 6 a.m. to start cooking, preparing salads, cooking six huge turkeys to feed our relatives and our cousins outside, and just make sure that they're taken care of and shown that love language of good food.
And what does it take to make, you know, these community dinners happen on a regular basis?
So we raise our funds through community ask, through mutual aid. We put out the request of, like, our bills are usually about $1,200 a week, and we raise that money and ask our community to come together and help us put it together, and we buy the groceries and get the deals that we can, and we cook all day and sometimes Saturday night into Sunday all day till it takes a lot of effort to cook a big Christmas dinner every single week. So it takes a lot of us to come together to make cookies and desserts and bring over necessities like hand warmers and socks and toques and all that good stuff. So and you have to make sure you have all the fixings. You need a drink, and you need salads and homemade buns and homemade gravy and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sounds delicious. You're making me hungry already. And how many volunteers is on the team?
We have a lot. Well, I really think it's our whole community. This area really comes together, and people that really care about our relatives that support 7th Gen. So I would say there's at least 200 of us, but there's at least 12 that come together every single week and really help put these dinners together. And we can really rely on our community, whatever we ask for, that we'll come together and find it and figure it out and work together to make it happen.
Mm. Tell me about some of your volunteers. Who are the people helping out in the kitchen?
We have a wonderful, amazing person. Her name's Sheena, and she makes our desserts for our dinners every week. And she literally spends every single day of the week making desserts for us. So we have hundreds of desserts to hand out. And so we're very lucky that we have her, and we have other people that make the buns. So I don't have to do everything. We all kind of come together. I have other folks that raise money so that they could get Tim Hortons cards for our relatives so that they can go in and get meals. Just things we can put inside the food bag that would make them happy. And so, yeah, it's like a big takeout bag, and you get like a chili and a hot plate of food, and there's buns and there's cookies in there, and there's usually a Tim Hortons card and pop or juice boxes, water bottles, and just kind of making it as full as love as we can get.
That does sound like a lot of love. And who are the people that you're serving? Who's coming for dinner?
A lot of folks that do not have homes that should be homed, like our elders out there. That part is really hard for me, because I really believe that losing an elder is like losing a library of knowledge and stories, and those should be the most respected people in our community, is our elders and our seniors, and they're outside without homes, without resources. And so, I mean, a meal once a week is not enough, but it's just kind of showing my love and my care however we are able to. So those are the kinds of people, and lots of kids too. Like, there is a lot of homeless children here in Saskatoon, and so we really are feeding the elderly, the children, lots of single moms that are just trying to hold it together. And yeah, we're just kind of coming together as a community of just trying to take care of each other as best we can.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of misconceptions about people who are homeless or, you know, are couch surfing youth, for example, or, you know, because they can't get into apartments or whatever reason. Mm-hmm. What kinds of stories do you hear from these relatives as you feed them?
Lots of sad stories. Lots of they can't, their benefits aren't coming in, or they have to apply for so many different things. And if you put one wrong thing on the application, it sets you back 3 weeks. And it's just, it's so much hills and red tape and so many reasons of just making it hard when it shouldn't be that hard to house our people.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it's important, you know, for you to serve Christmas dinners, you know, particularly at this time?
Just showing up for our people and showing up for our relatives and letting them know that even if it's winter time, like, we will not stop and we won't forget about them and we won't just leave them freeze or not be able to survive another harsh winter. I think it's important that we feed them as much as we can so that they can recover these, recover from addictions or recover from overdoses and be able to survive a winter, like literally pack on the pounds so that they could survive a harsh winter.
Mm-hmm. Where did you, you know, find the inspiration, the drive to do this work? Why do you give back this way?
You know, there's so many people before me that was doing this work. And there's an amazing guy in Saskatoon, a two-spirit person named Tuck Gordon, and he was the sandwich guy. And, like, very heavily in 2011, he was out there in the community feeding our relatives and being a good elder, or, like, being a good relative, learning how to be a good elder, learning how to walk in a good way for our people and show them that our people, we take care of each other, and that's what being Indigenous is giving what everything you have, basically, because you already have everything you need.
When you say, you know, to be a good relative, what does that mean to you?
It means taking care of my family. It means making sure all my cousins are good and safe and supplying them with whatever they need, because I have everything I need, and I feel very grateful and blessed, and I just want to make sure that my relatives feel the same way. And to me, that's the most important, is just taking care of our community and being a good neighbor and that sort of thing. Yeah.
You mentioned the sandwich guy who, you know, did this, mm-hmm. started doing this heart work back in 2011. But was there someone in your life who inspired you or continues to inspire you to do this work?
You know, my mom is an amazing woman. She's just always worked in community. She worked in healthcare. She was a nurse growing up. So, and she worked in group homes. And she always took care of everyone. And I just thought that's what you should do. You should take care of people. You should make sure people are safe and happy. And so I just grew up watching that kind of mentality. And she still continues heavily to work in community, and she takes care of our people so well. And so I just want to be like her.
Aw, I love that. Do you see yourself in these people that you care for?
Yes, a lot. Like these, when I say these are like my cousins and my relatives, I really mean that, because I do serve my cousins. Like I have seen my family members outside. I have lost family to addiction, and you know, like we struggled growing up. We always used food banks. My mom was only 15 when she had me. So we've seen it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that bit of your story with me. Mm-hmm. What do you wish people knew about, you know, the people that you care for, especially those who are living on the streets or are young people?
I feel like people in this area, like they say Saskatoon is can be dangerous here. And I really think that is like a propaganda stance, because these are people that are just trying to survive. And if you were trying to survive, like you would also have to resort to crime of that nature. You would have to do whatever you could to survive. And people don't have enough patience or understanding to realize that a lot of people are dealing with mental health issues, and a lot of that gets swept under the rug and it's not taken care of. And there's so much stereotypes on Indigenous people and just like the harm that is brought to our people because of stereotypes. And so I just want to remind everyone, that's why I always call them relatives.
Yeah.
Because that is someone's son, that is someone's cousin, that is someone's mother. And you know, I think people can forget that, to humanize them, that it's not just like a bad guy or a drunk guy. That's someone in our family who's struggling.
Yeah. If somebody is listening that is inspired and wants to help, how what are some things that people can do to help those our relatives on the street?
Honestly, you can just talk to them, ask them what they need. Just be kind, show kindness. Ask them if they need a coat or if there's a pair of shoes that you're not wearing. You could talk to your local community grassroots project that has been already doing the work within community. It's really important too that when you're dealing with Indigenous people and you want to show them respect, and having another Indigenous face dealing with Indigenous faces is very important. So if you're having organized groups, having an Indigenous person lead that group is extremely important, because having that comfort and safety is the utmost important when dealing with community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kat, thank you so much for your time today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Kat Monroe is the founder of the Seventh Generation Rising, an Indigenous-led mutual aid group helping folks in need in Saskatoon. She is from Kisikoos First Nation. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, Amanda Gear, and Rhiannon Johnson. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. You didn't ask Mikinawa. I guess so.